On today's episode, using power meters to run faster with Cody Van Russell. Welcome to the podcast helping you train, rehab, and run smarter. When I first started running in my 20s, I knew it would be something I'd be passionate about for the rest of my life. But unfortunately, developing injury after injury disrupted my progress and left me undertrained at the start line on race day. Even with my knowledge as a physio, I still fell victim to the vicious injury cycle, and when searching for answers, struggled to decipher between common running myths and evidence-based guidance. That's what this podcast is here to help you with. So join me as a Run Smarter scholar, and let's break the injury cycle by raising your running IQ and achieving running feats you never thought possible. Welcome back, Run Smarter Scholars. We have another running researcher who was suggested from Hannah Dimmick, who was on a few months ago, talking about parameters and running fatigue and those sorts of things. And she passed me on to her colleague, Cody, who has done a lot of research into power meters and how we can best understand power, but also some practical takeaways of how you can run faster. And while the start of the conversation takes us through, I guess, the understanding power, where the research is on the definition and converting cycling power to running power, it takes the direction of, okay, how can we use this? Can we use it? Is it reliable? What are the limitations? If we do want to run faster, what are some practical implementations that we can make? And I think it was a great conversation. And coming from someone who's done the research and is very well versed in it was very good to have Cody on. So I hope you enjoy, and let's kick off today's conversation. Cody, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Hey, no worries. Happy to be here.
I want to get started with a bit of a background from you, bring the audience up to speed about what your research background is and sort of your particular line of research.
I've done a bunch of different things. I'm not really sure how I ended up where I'm at right now. I decided to go back and do my master's. I was personal training for years after my undergraduate degree. I have an undergraduate degree in kinesiology. And on my way to like week one of class, I got in a motorcycle accident, which gave me a pretty bad concussion, which actually kind of changed my destiny, I think, to some degree. After I graduated from my master's degree, I worked in a concussion lab. So just really trying to figure out my own health. And I thought it would be perfect to dive into a research lab and kind of get it right from the horse's mouth, if you will. And I did a bunch of research there, primarily as a coordinator. So I would collect data, did some writing, some presentations and whatnot, and didn't learn as much as I would have liked to. It was much different type of research than I thought it would be. The physiology side is what has always been something more of interest to me and what I really enjoyed. So I went back to school. That was probably in 2018, 2019, to pursue a PhD. And so more exercise physiology based, so kind of high performance sport. And I had an opportunity to work with some wearable devices. So there's some grant money, which I applied to work with essentially wearable technology in all different respects. And that's around the time I heard about the Stride Running Pod and inertial measurement units and kind of heart rate variability. And I tried to incorporate every type of wearable sensor that I could think of into my research, and then pursued that for the last kind of 3-4 years. And as of more recently, I've got into some stuff. I think I'm starting to really find my niche and figure out what I really enjoy. And I've gotten into something called nonlinear analysis of essentially biological signals. So your kind of standard heart rate variability and biomechanical assessments of stride time, stride length, and trying to make sense of the human body, but from a less traditional standpoint. So kind of implementing aspects of chaos theory into my research, and it's been a good time. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Excellent, mate. Yeah, because I know the particular topic that we want to discuss today is around about running power and how runners can find it useful, use it as a tool, and I guess learn and understand more about it. And I know you've done a couple of recent papers or a couple of your recent papers around power. Talk us through like running power, like what, how can we measure it? How is it important? Why is it important?
It's a much more difficult question to answer than I anticipated when I started to get into it. I think it's worth discussing cycling power because I think if you're a runner that also bikes and you're fairly serious about your cycling and your training, you'll have a cycling power meter, and it's most people know what cycling power is. It's very commonly used. It's essentially ubiquitous with cyclists, right? So if you're a professional cyclist, you have a cycling power meter. And if you're a professional runner, you may or may not have a power meter. So the question becomes, why do cyclists have a power meter and why do runners not have a power meter? And now that these kind of wearable sensors are coming out with what they call running power, what is it and what does it do? And that's where things get a little bit weird. I think it might be worth discussing what mechanical power is and what economy of movement is as well. So when we talk about mechanical power and from a cyclist perspective, it's straightforward, right? So you can have a cycling power meter, and what you're measuring is external power output, right? So your muscles will produce forces, and you have something external to the body that is actually can evaluate what those muscles are outputting, right? So when we look at mechanical power and mechanical power efficiency, what that is the relationship between how much energy your body expends to produce a certain power output or muscular output at either the crank on your bike or the pedals or the rear hub or the wheel. So you actually have something external to the body that is your muscles are producing. And it's quite easy to measure. It's very useful for cyclists because particularly because for mechanical power output on a bike, most people are around 20% efficient, or their mechanical efficiency would be around 20%, which means that if you had, let's say, 1,000 watts of energy input into the system or energy expenditure, you would output about 200 watts, right? So if you're cycling at 200 watts, your body requires about 1,000 watts to produce that power. And that maintains the same relationship whether you have a strong headwind, whether you're cycling up a hill, whether you're cycling down a hill, whether you're cycling in gravel, or whether you have a heavy bike or a light bike. It's the only real thing that affects that relationship is cycling cadence. So that can affect it around up to 10% of the variance is what we would say. But for running, things are much more, I don't know, ambiguous, I guess you could say. And
complicated and I guess a bit more dynamic. There's a lot more moving parts going on.
Absolutely. I guess like the easiest way to look at it or to explain it is that there is no equivalent external kind of ergometer for running, right? So you're not producing a tangible output, right? So because the muscular forces that are being produced are just to keep the body moving, right? And there's no agreed upon metric for what running power is in the biomechanical realm, and there's many different ways to measure it. The biggest problem is that if you look at the body from kind of an energetics perspective, so how much potential energy the system has or how much kinetic energy the system has, if you're running at the same speed, so say you're running at 7 kilometers an hour, 10 kilometers an hour, there's no change in your kinetic energy. That's still the same. That forward motion is maintained the whole time, right? So you're maintaining that 10 kilometers an hour. And then you have vertical forces or forces going up and down. You can look at the system in terms of a ball bouncing, right? So the ball will fall down and it'll have an increase in energy, or that potential energy will be used to fall down, and then it will return back upwards, right? So kinetic energy doesn't change, and potential energy over a gate cycle is the same, right? So it falls down and it comes back up. So from that kind of energetics perspective, their mechanical power is zero, right? So your efficiency is essentially zero, because you have an energy required to produce that muscular force, but the output is 0 watts, which is a little bit strange to think, right? So all these biomechanists will come up with a number of different assumptions to try and evaluate the system. So you'll kind of assume that maybe we'll count the motion down and add it to the motion up. So you're kind of adding a negative to a positive. And then to get some type of tangible measure of what mechanical power output is. And I guess to make a long story short, we've never really agreed upon a particular way to evaluate what running power is. And there is a wide range of what a true running power could be. And within a lab setting, we would use things like force plates. We would use motion capture. So we could look at either the movement of the center of mass of the body, or we can actually evaluate power in terms of all the joints and try and summate them together to try and get some tangible measure of power. So to make that really confusing for everybody, I guess most people, obviously they're not concerned about what, you know, running power is in a lab setting, but now there's these running power meters that you can purchase. So the question is like, what is that? And there's a lot of maybe animosity towards what these different companies are trying to produce, because I guess at first they're saying like it can't be running power, it's not mechanical power, and that's true. So we're not. If you put an inertial measurement unit is what they are commonly, what they are. So they'll measure accelerations in the vertical direction, horizontal direction, and then I guess on your the third axis. And they'll also measure rotational forces using a gyroscope. And they'll have a magnetometer. So they're accelerometers. From a research perspective, we'll call them inertial measurement units. They'll do a number of different things, but they'll give you a measurement of accelerations. And what these companies will do is they'll try and take that information and make some type of evaluation of estimation of what running power is, or what they're more likely doing is giving themselves or creating their own metric of what running power is. So the people that criticize running power from these kind of consumer devices, they're right in the fact that it's not a true measure of mechanical power. But from where I'm coming from, my research is I'm trying to see, okay, if it may not be a true measure of mechanical power, is that metric useful? And can you use it like a cycling power meter? So can you use that output from that sensor on your foot or your wrist and use that to direct your training in a similar way to how a cyclist would direct their training?
Yeah. Can you maybe talk through, because the devices I'm familiar with would be like the Stride Pod, seems to be like one of the most common and commonly used, which you just place on your shoelace and you just put it on one shoe, and then like you say, it has an accelerometer to gather some metrics and spits out some data that might be their version of what power is, and you sort of use that within your training. What are some other devices? I know you might have mentioned there's some on your wrists, and is there one that you might recommend more in terms of accuracy or what data they're actually collecting that might be more helpful?
Yeah, so there's a lot of the kind of standard companies have come up with their own power meter, and the metric that they produce does not seem to be interchangeable, right? So if you're a cyclist and you're trying to measure cycling power, whether you're measuring it at the pedal or the crank or the rear wheel, the metric that you're after should be the same across devices, right? So that evaluation of power should be the exact same if your power meter is accurate, from kind of whether it's Polar or Garmin or Stride or a potential other device that's trying to measure power. It seems that the metric that they're producing is quite different at any given running intensity. And so if you're using Polar power, I believe they use GPS in relation to changes in elevation and running speed. And you'll enter your body mass into your watch to get, or it will adjust that running power metric, where something like the Stride Running pod can evaluate power without requiring a GPS signal. So how they're doing it is to some degree a bit of a black box. So I'm not sure. I can kind of only speculate based on the data that I get, or I'll evaluate Stride Running power at the same time that I'm evaluating accelerations from my own accelerometer, and I can try and kind of reverse engineer the signal to see if I can create that Stride power metric. But it seems that Stride is producing its metric from accelerations at the foot, primarily from horizontal velocities and estimates of vertical displacement of the foot. And yeah, so that will respond differently if you're running on a treadmill versus if you're running outside, mm-hmm. because of the fact that you have no change. Even if you're running on a treadmill at an incline, the vertical displacement of your foot will always come back down to the same place, because you're not going to gain displacement. So the Stride Power Pod will work on a treadmill, but you'll need to tell it at what incline you're actually running at. So it's not that smart just yet. It can't detect changes in treadmill incline, where its primary use is to work if you're running outside and on a trail with adjustments and running grade.
Okay. With, I guess, knowing that different devices or different companies use different data, and it's not this uniform power that you're actually using, in your line of research, do you recommend runners use a power device or incorporate power in some way to be helpful for their training?
I'm most familiar with the Stride power meter. It seems to be, or that device seems to be the most researched device, and it seems to produce the most quote unquote valid, reliable and repeatable measure of running power, or essentially what they call power. So I've produced three different research papers using the Stride power meter. The first one, we used it to try and estimate exercising thresholds, where we compared an equation we made where we used VO2 and running speed. And then separately, we used VO2 and Stride running power to evaluate or detect exercising thresholds. In that case, it turned out that the Stride running power produced better predictions, which was actually not what we expected. we thought they'd be quite similar, but Stride seemed to produce better predictions. A second study, we compared, if your listeners are familiar with a term called critical speed. So what we did is we had runners do time trials for 1200 meters, 2400 meters, and approximately 36 to 4400 meters to evaluate critical speed. And from the Stride running power data at each of those different distances, we also determined power, or kind of average power, each of those distances and evaluated critical power. So it's a very similar concept, where essentially through a mathematical equation, we can evaluate or detect kind of the highest sustainable running speed, which is your critical speed, or the highest sustainable running power, which is your critical power. And we wanted to see, are those metrics equivalent? So at least on flat running, performed on a running track, those metrics were equivalent. So your running speed at critical speed was the same as your running power during your critical speed run. And I also wrote a paper, which was, what was it called? It was essentially, is you know, is running power a useful metric for runners? And we evaluated the metric with relation to VO2 max, exercising thresholds. We wanted to see, is it repeatable? Is it reliable? How does it relate to fitness? How does it relate to running economy? And it seems to be quite reliable. So the metric that you're getting one day is going to be very similar to the metric you're getting another day. However they devise that stride running power metric, whatever it is, how their kind of background algorithms work is they adjust that metric towards a similar measure to what you'd expect from cycling power, which I thought was quite interesting. So at the beginning, I was discussing cycling power and how a cyclist is approximately 20% efficient, or the mechanical efficiency is around 20%. We discovered that stride running power produces a similar metric. So if you're running at 200 watts from your stride running power, you require around 1,000 watts of energy kind of input into the system. So kind of stride watts are similar to cycling power watts. I wouldn't suggest that you use them interchangeably, or if you're kind of cycling on the weekend for 5 hours at 180 watts and you go for a run for 5 hours at 180 watts, I wouldn't suggest that they're exactly equivalent, but they're quite similar, which was quite interesting. But it seems that, yeah, so from that perspective, stride seems to be a metric that is kind of trying to go for, I guess, athletes and people that are training. They're trying to produce a metric that is the most similar to stride or to cycling power, which is, I think, what the goal should probably be. So we know that it's not a true measure of mechanical power, but it seems to be producing some metric that can be used.
Just quickly chiming in here to let you scholars know, I have just updated my 5-day injury prevention challenge. This is one email per day for 5 days, learning new concepts and diving into the science on how you can reduce your risk of injury. The sign-up link is in the show notes, so fill in your details and I'll be waiting for you in email number one tomorrow.
A similar capacity to what a cyclist would use.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. It's good that you've done the research to know that it's reproducible, valid, and something that can be quite useful. In terms of like a practical sense for a recreational runner who might have a stride device or maybe considering purchasing a similar sort of device, how can we use these devices to become better runners? How can we utilize these in a practical sense?
I want to say, yeah, just to take you back, I want to say kind of valid in quotation marks, because we did never compare it to a true measure of mechanical power. Because it's kind of that, it's very difficult to do. We don't know what true running power is. But if a runner was to go and purchase a running power meter, so there seems to be more and more companies that are developing these running power metrics. I would suggest sticking to the same one if you are using one. Sorry, can you repeat your question? How would you use it to guide your training? Kind of.
If a recreational runner was to use it, like in what practical way could they use it to become a better runner or like enhance their training in any way?
Yeah. So I think where it would be the most useful and where I think there's still a bit of a gap in the research is when you are running outside in a hilly kind of terrain, if you're running in gravel, if you're running against the headwind, you know, can you just set your workout to 200 watts and say for yourself that might be zone two and your goal is to run at 200 watts zone two for, you know, 80 minutes that day, and that's your workout. So that is essentially the purpose of these power meters, right? It's because once you start using the monitor, if you were to hold 200 watts, if it works properly, you're going to have a change in running speed, right? You'll slow your running speed as you approach a hill. and you'll try to maintain the 200 watts. And as you go down a hill, you might increase your running speed to maintain that, again, 200 watts, right? So the idea is that you're maintaining the same power so that you're having the same kind of metabolic requirements for any given exercise intensity. And that's where it would be a very, I'm trying to stay away from saying powerful device, but very useful device, because, you know, there's a lot of limitations to guiding the exercise from running speed perspective. As you know, as soon as you introduce some type of incline or headwind or icy surface, or if you're living in Canada like myself, if you're running in snow, running speed is not a good way to direct your training, right? So you're going to, if you're running in snow, you're going to have to slow down your speed in order to maintain the same intensity. If the stride running power meter works as well as it, we hope it does, then even if your speed is slower, but you're still running at 200 watts, then the requirement or the kind of metabolic requirement for that task maintains or is the same.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I think that'd be incredibly useful because as runners, we know that we want to avoid abrupt changes in load. We want to avoid abrupt changes that exceed our capacity to adapt if we want to reduce our risk of injury. And if there is a long session in the hills, you can't essentially just say, oh yeah, I did a 10-kilometer run last week, let me just do a 10-kilometer run this week. But if there is more hills, it's like, well, do I peg it back? If I do allow for these hills, do I do an 8K or a 7K? Like, where's the trade-off there? Where's the balance?
Yeah, you touch on a good point, right? Because many runners, they'll quantify their training load or their training volume, whatever they want to call it, or they'll try and periodize their training by increasing running distance, increasing running time, where it's probably or arguably more important to determine what intensity each of those training sessions are at, right? And as you get fitter, if you're running at the same speed but for longer, that might be a lower intensity, but if a longer duration. So it becomes very challenging to only use distance and time to quantify your training volume, right? So if you're, I think generally the people that are using these types of monitors are going to be longer distance runners. But for example, if one of those longer distance runners went to a track and they did 400 meter sprint repeats as a training session, right? So that training volume may be dramatically lower than what they're used to, right? So maybe they did 5 400 meter repeats and, you know, they're having a fraction of the training distance or the actual time spent running, but that training stimulus is going to be much, much longer, right? So in your example of introducing running hills into your sessions, right? So that's going to change how or the intensity of your exercise if you're maintaining the same running speed when you're running through those hills, right? So can you adjust that intensity by slowing your running speed so that the actual physiological intensity is the same, even though your running speed changes?
Do they have a metric, like when you finish your run, if you're doing up and down in the hills, at the end of your run, does it calculate your average power, like measured throughout that entire run?
Yeah, so you can look at your run afterwards and look at your running power. So I currently have a Polar Vantage V2, and when I run with the stride power meter, it will give you, you can adjust the actual metrics on your watch, but you can see average power during your workout. You can see your current power and then maximal power or similar metrics to that. Yeah.
Because I'm thinking a lot of the ways I rate my effort levels is by, or I guess exercise units would be a way to describe it, would be to calculate my average effort for a run out of 10 and then multiply that by the minutes of that session. And so if it's an average of a 3 out of 10 intensity and it's a 30-minute session, I'll just give myself a 90-point exercise units and then try to make sure there's no abrupt changes week to week and those sorts of things. But the big limitation with that is if, say, this morning when I had to do 1K, like 3x1K efforts, and then do some hill sprints and then do some strides and like all those sorts of things that are quite like high intensity, different intensities, different durations. And there's a whole bunch of mixture of things going on. It's very hard to spit out a good, accurate depiction of what's actually happened. But if I had a power meter and this gave me the average power, I could just multiply the average power by the minutes, and then I have a score there, which might be consistent. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the million-dollar question is, and that's something that comes with, I think, a lot of experience from coaches, from athletes, to really determine what is the best metric. If there is only one, I'd suggest that there isn't. It's probably a combination of things to really evaluate the total stress of training and to try and either taper or add volume, add intensity in order to get better, to get faster. I think cyclists will often just use the power metric itself in terms of the average power or power with or in relation to their exercise intensity zones, where they demarcate each of those zones by using power cutoffs, where I think runners are not by choice, but they'll more commonly use heart rate zones, which are probably have a number of additional limitations than if you were to, you know, determine your exercise intensity zones using something like running power. But I think something that you're referring to is commonly called TRIMS, at least in from my area of research. And I don't want to say any of these things are bad, because a lot of them, they have practical utility depending on your setting and who you are, and dependent upon the type of metrics you can actually use, right? So if you were a swimmer or a triathlete, you know, you're not going to be able to, or there is no current power meter, right? So you're going to be limited to potentially measuring heart rate, or looking at asking yourself, you know, how hard was that session on a 6 to 20 scale or 0 to 10 scale. And all those metrics can be useful. It's kind of determining or understanding the limitations of each of those metrics and trying to pull them together to really give you a good idea as to how is my body responding to the exercise training? How am I feeling right now? How much of my physical stress is related to my psychological state? Or even maybe I traveled for an event, maybe I'm tired, maybe I'm dehydrated, maybe there's an additional stress in my life that is unrelated to my training that is impacting my performance, right? So those become difficult metrics to measure. I think probably the most commonly used metric, at least for cyclists, is they would use exercise intensity zones, and they would kind of draw a line at each of these zones using a specific power output, because they know if they're in a very controlled setting, they can hold or maintain very specific powers for, you know, well-known durations of time. And then regardless of changes in the external environment, they know if I maintain this power output, I can sustain that power output for X amount of minutes. So the idea with running is that you can do that exact same thing, is you can kind of set your exercise for the day, and you're saying, okay, I want to maintain 300 watts for 45 minutes, and you go out and do that. And if you're a cross-country runner or potentially running on the streets and there's slight changes in hills or external condition, then you can do that. Or if you're using something like heart rate, heart rate will have a delay, will have what we call kinetics, right? There's a lag in how your heart rate responds to any given intensity, right? So if you were to sprint up a set of stairs, your heart rate will lag behind, or your heart rate will probably be the highest as soon as you stop running up the stairs, and then it will peak, right? So there's a lag, which is difficult to use heart rate when you're doing longer sessions, or if you're in a hot day. So heart rate will be affected by you know, other external conditions, like if you're in a busy road and there's lots of traffic, that can potentially affect your heart rate. Or athletes will they'll be prone to something called cardiac drift. So over long durations of exercise, they're even at the same exercise intensity from a physiological standpoint, heart rate will slowly drift up higher and higher. And that's from changes in fluid shifts in the body. So when your muscles contract, when you're pumping blood throughout the body, some of that blood, so the blood plasma can go towards the muscles, where some of that muscle or some of that hydration will be lost to the sweat. So you have fluid shifts and less plasma in the blood, so your heart will have to pump harder for any given intensity. There's many factors that will affect that. So just using your heart rate to determine intensity becomes very difficult, where if you're at the same power, that power output responds immediately. And at least more in a controlled setting, you know that through practice, or you will be able to know that I can maintain this power for this long. Speed works in a very similar way. As long as you're running at, you know, a 0% grade and without any headwind, if you're running on the same surface, like a paved road. But as soon as you change any of those things, that's where something like a power meter can be much more useful.
Which, you know, whenever someone racing, I guess maybe on a track, but like when it comes to, say, a marathon that most of my audience would do, or a half marathon, very, very rarely is it pancake flat. There's always some sort of variable in there, which raises a very interesting point. If you had, even if it was a hilly marathon, and people say, you know what, I think I can hold this marathon pace. They usually have a marathon goal pace or something that they like to keep to. But then as soon as there's hills, it's hard to really factor in what will be my average or what sort of pace should I keep up this hill, those sorts of things. But you're saying if we have these power zones and you say, I know I can maintain this power throughout the duration of the marathon, then you will slow down on the uphill and you might increase your speed on the downhill or those sorts of things. But if you hold a consistent power the entire time and you know that you can maintain that power through training and training zones and those sort of calculations, then that would theoretically help increase your performance.
Absolutely. So that's very much the kind of Stride performance platform. That's what they are trying to sell with their product. There's a company called Coros, and I'm not sure if this is true yet, but I think they have some ideas to implement something called, essentially where they still want to use pace, but it's grade adjusted pace. So they'll show you how to adjust your pace based on changes in gradient or changes in external condition, because runners may understand pace better than they understand power, but it's essentially the same thing. It's trying to take that accelerometer information and give you a metric to adjust your running speed, or that's essentially what we can change as runners, right? So runners very irregularly try and think of what your cadence is, or what am I doing with my arms, right? It seems to be something that comes more natural with training. You know, what is your cadence? What is your preferred gait? You know, how do you run? There's many different ways or types of ways to run. And with training, it seems that the human body will adjust their mechanics to be the most effective runner.
Do you know what might be the most useful test for someone to calculate their power zones? Because by my understanding, you need to do a certain like power threshold test or something along those lines to then assign your own personal power zones. Do you have any idea around that?
So there's some programs to help you do this, but the most effective way to at least determine or at least distinguish between a running intensity that is quote unquote sustainable and unsustainable, or in terms of, or from a physiologist perspective, above or below threshold, is using something like a critical speed or critical power test. And that's what I was referring to at the beginning. So critical speed is the asymptote between the relationship of running velocity and time. And that's probably a difficult thing to interpret in your head. But if you were to run at 1200 meters as fast as you can write down a time. So that would be three laps on a track. And then if you were to run 2400 meters as fast as you can, so probably on a separate day, get yourself a time, and then run closer to a time where you can sustain for about 15 minutes, which may be, let's say 4 kilometers, so 10 laps on an outdoor track. So what critical speed is the relationship between the decrease in running velocity and running time, where as running distance increases, that velocity dramatically decreases exponentially. And you get this nice curve where we define the plateau in that curve as your critical speed or the theoretical speed that you can sustain indefinitely, which isn't true, but from a mathematical perspective, it seems, that's kind of what the definition is. And we commonly use that to differentiate between running speeds that can be sustained for a long time and running speeds that cannot be sustained for a long time. So that's kind of what we refer to as the exercise threshold. On like a 1 to 5 exercise intensity zone, that would be, or usually is at kind of your zone 4. So your kind of threshold speed or threshold power. So much higher than the kind of zone 2, which most marathon runners might actually exercise in. And something like a zone 2, it's a little bit more difficult to measure by yourself. There's some other evaluations that use heart rate variability, which is a little bit outside of the talk for today, but those type of metrics can help determine that first exercise threshold or kind of that lower threshold around zone 2.
So once you have those times, so they've done their 1200 meters, their 2400 meters, and maybe like a 15 minute time trial. Once you have those numbers, is there something they can plug? Can they plug those values into a system or a program to spit out what their critical power might be?
Yeah. So there's some programs called Golden Cheetah, which will do that for you.
Okay.
Training Peaks are companies and programs that will do that for you, I believe. At least Golden Cheetah for sure. I know you can get access for free. I can't remember with Training Peaks. But there's some fairly simple math that you could apply to determine it, but more accessible to most audiences. You can use some of these programs and some of these programs will actually direct that or help you determine that. The Stride platform itself will actually offer you or help guide you to do that, and they will calculate that by themselves. So the Stride device and the Stride platform will actually take your best performances whenever you go for a run. So you don't have to go to a track and do this at maximal intensity. That would probably be the best way to get the most accurate assessment of that kind of upper intensity, but they'll extract your best performances that you maintain for say 3 minutes, or the highest average power output that you sustain for 3 minutes, or the highest average power output you sustain for 8 minutes and around 15 minutes. And they'll try and determine that curve for you without you having to do anything at all. And they'll call that the Stride critical power. So that's something, if you were to buy yourself the Stride pod, you can access that information for free and without doing anything besides linking your power meter to your watch or your phone and uploading that data. So it becomes much easier or user-friendly.
Yeah. Just quickly on the critical speed or critical power, you say like below that would be something that you can maintain for quite a while. And like above that is something that's, I guess, unsustainable. Would that be more like aerobic, anaerobic kind of thresholdy sort of stuff?
Yeah. So that would probably be what a lot of coaches and athletes would refer to as your anaerobic threshold, or kind of exercise below that threshold can be sustained through aerobic metabolic sources. And as soon as you go above it, you're requiring anaerobic energy systems to maintain that intensity. Yeah.
Okay, good to know. As we're wrapping this up, I know you've done other work other than power stuff. You sort of know a lot about running economy and that sort of thing. I thought I'd just ask while I've got you on the podcast, aside from power, are there any other tips that you might have for runners who want to increase their running performance and become more mechanically efficient or something like that?
Sure. Yeah. I think, at least in my experience working with runners, being a runner, it seems that longer distance runners seem to, you know, stay away from lifting weights, exercise setting. But if you were to look at a runner from their, you know, running economy, if you want to improve running economy, a good way to do it is by strength training or doing some type of sprint training or bounding or plyometric training. And it comes from the perspective of the mechanics of your lower leg primarily. So the triceps serrae, which are your gastroc and soleus muscles, they account for roughly 25 to 40% of the total metabolic cost of running, which is massive in my perspective for muscles that are fairly small in comparison to, you know, your quadriceps, hamstrings, your glutes. But they have a massive energy demand when you run. So if you're fitter or a more economical runner, you're probably closer to that 25% of the metabolic requirement of running. And if you're less trained or more uneconomical, requiring more energy to travel, then you might be closer to that 40%. So when we talk about running economy, you can think of it as the economy of a car, right? So how much fuel do you require to travel a certain distance? All right, so if you want to become a more economical runner, you want to reduce the amount of fuel to travel the same distance, or use the same fuel to travel further. So if you can adjust the mechanics of the lower leg, if you can improve the mechanics of your lower leg, primarily the kind of the muscles of the triceps serrae and your Achilles tendon, then you can become more economical. And that's through doing things like either strengthening the muscles of your lower leg or even of your legs as a whole. So, and that's from the perspective of, if you think of it as, if you're running and you require 10 units of muscle force, and to run, let's say you're running at 10 kilometers an hour and you require 10 units of muscle force. If the total force of your muscles is 50, then, you know, that's 20% of that capacity, right? But if you can make those muscles stronger, and let's say that muscle capacity is 100 units, but you still only require 10 units of force to run at 10 kilometers an hour, you're exercising at a much lower muscular intensity, right? So those muscles can generally kind of contract at a lower intensity. The other kind of aspect of that is increasing the stiffness of your tendon. And if you can, through kind of your sprint training or bounding, so there's lots of different ways to improve that. I'm sure there's kind of YouTube pages you could look up or YouTube videos you can check out for something like that. So if you can improve the mechanics of your Achilles tendon, what the goal is, not something you have to worry about specifically, but by essentially stiffening up that tendon, then every time your foot comes in contact with the ground, if your muscles can contract less, if they can maintain more of an isometric contraction, the energy cost of your contraction dramatically decreases. The more your muscle lengthens and then shortens every time you come in contact with the ground, the more energy cost is required for any given foot strike. So just through simple things like that, I know from a runner's perspective, like, they don't want to put on additional muscle mass, and that's probably, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, and that's probably not a goal for most endurance runners. But if you can increase the strength of your muscles, if you can improve the particularly from the Achilles tendon perspective, you can improve the if you can make it more pliable or close to not more pliable, but like less pliable or close to what is more optimal, you can improve your running economy, which will allow you to run a given distance with less energy. But yeah.
Great. So with focus on the calves, that being focusing on building strength, and that sort of gets the muscle fibers, more muscle fibers to produce more force. So you're essentially, yeah, you can push off, but then stiffness as well. So the plyometric bounding sort of stuff works on stiffness, so less moving parts, and therefore more of an economical process when it comes to hitting the ground, pushing off, and those sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. So making your muscles stronger so they can contract at a lower relative intensity, and making your tendons stiffer so that when you are making contact with the ground and need to push off, your muscles are required to shorten and or lengthen and shorten less. So the less muscle work your muscles do, and the more kind of that, lengthening and shortening that your tendons can do in place of the muscles, then that can improve your economy.
Great, mate. Good way to finish up. Back to the power stuff. Is there any other final takeaways or any other things we might have missed that you'd like recreational runners to know, or maybe something that is worth repeating?
I think we still need to address kind of just limitations of the device, right? So as soon as you're putting a device just on your foot, you know, we need to acknowledge the fact that it's not going to be perfect. We need to acknowledge that it is not the same metric that a cycling power meter is producing. But if it can evaluate exercise intensity in a similar way, that's awesome. With that being said, if you substantially restrict motion of your upper body, that's going to make you less economical. And if nothing is changing at your foot, then the device isn't going to be able to detect that. If you dramatically, you know, increase or decrease cadence, it may not be as good of an indicator of your exercise intensity. So just based on what the device is and where it's, you know, detecting that change in running gait, there's going to be some limitations of it. Yeah, I'm not too sure. I think we still need to develop some research and see how well the device actually does work in an outdoor condition with changes in incline. We know that it works quite well during, you know, fairly level treadmill running, but there is some gaps in the research right now. That's something I'm working on currently, but it seems to be a promising area. It seems to be something that is going to be useful for runners in the future. And that doesn't mean that you want to disregard your heart rate metric. That's still telling you a lot about what your body is doing and how it's responding to exercise, asking yourself how hard you're working. So basic, you know, 0 to 10 measurement of the overall exercise load or throughout the duration of your exercise is going to be very, very useful. If you have, say, an extra backpack on when you're running through the hills, or if you're mountain climbing or whatever, we don't know how well the device responds with its power metric when there's an additional load, or inversely, if you're running for a long time and you lost, you know, 6-7 pounds or, you know, 4 kilos of water because you're very dehydrated after a long run. We don't know if the Stride device will adjust for that dehydration. So there's still some research that needs to be done, but it seems to be a pretty cool device. I do use it myself, and I do, you know, I have no direct investment in Stride, but I think it's a pretty cool device, and I'll definitely continue to use it myself. Yeah.
Yeah. I recently had another running researcher, Bradley Neal, on the podcast, and he was just talking about his, like, it's a feasibility study, but mentioned that there seems to be a stronger link with developing a running related injury with an increase in effort rather than an increase in total distance. If we're accumulating week by week and looking at the chronic acute to chronic ratio with effort, seems to be more correlated with injuries than distance, just looking at distance. And we need to try and find ways we can that calculate effort and measure effort and do those sorts of things to become better runners. And like you say, there are limitations. There's limitations with perceived effort. There's limitations with heart rate, but it does seem like power is a good way to at least use that as a tool in your arsenal. And so I think understanding power and that sort of stuff is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a be-all and all metric, but it's going to be, I think, a very useful device to add to your heart rate strap, to your RPE, to your total distance, to your speed. It will be, I think, very helpful to guide your training and optimize performance. So,
Cody, I want to thank you for coming on. Thanks for all the research that you're doing. I know it's a lot of time and effort to write and organize and design all these studies, and it does take a long time. And your expertise is very well appreciated on this podcast. So thanks for coming on and sharing to all the runners that are listening.
Cool. No, I really appreciate you inviting me. It's not many times that I get a chance to share some of the stuff I'm working on with people that are willing to listen. So I'm happy to chat.
Excellent, mate. And if any other new revelations come out, any other research that you're working on that can help runners, I'd be happy to get you to come back on.
Cool. That sounds good.
If you are struggling to overcome an injury, you can jump on a free 20-minute injury chat with me, which you can book through my calendar in the show notes. While you're in the show notes, elevate your running IQ by jumping onto my free email list so you can receive material to help rehab your injury, lower your injury risk, and increase your performance. If emails aren't for you, consider my Facebook group, Instagram, and YouTube channels. And remember, each insight you get from these resources brings you one step closer to your next running breakthrough.